Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention? I'm Rod Finkel, the president of the council, and thank you all for coming today. Obviously, winter's approaching also. As you know, we're a membership organization, and if you're not a member, we certainly invite you to join. We have membership cards at the door, and we would be happy to sign you up and give you a membership and then send you our weekly notices of our programs. I should also like to remind you that as an organization, we present speakers on international and national issues. The views of the speakers are not necessarily those of the council. We take no sides on issues presented. We want you to make your own decisions. I'd like to thank our guest speaker, Dr. Bob Musil, for taking time to speak to about 150 students at Service High this morning. And we're also bringing him to the high school Model UN Conference tonight, where he will be the feature speaker. I'd like to thank Will Thor, who you can't see. He's around the corner here. He's a board member, and he's doing our recording for today for Alaska World Affairs Presents. It's a podcast available at kska.org. Early next week, today's program will be available for you to download on the KSKA Public Radio website. Just go to kska.org and search and AWAC Presents. I think we're about ready for the head table at this point. To my very far left is Michael Cook. He is a member of the Board of Directors for the Alaska World Affairs Council. Thank you, Michael, for coming. And sitting next to him is Tam Auguste Giesler, who is also a member of Board of Directors, and she will be introducing our guest speaker today. So, Tam, just before you do that, let me make one comment. Following the presentation, we'll take questions, and our assistant will carry the mic around. When you ask your question, would you please stand and let the assistant hold the microphone for you? That way we don't lose microphones. Tam?
It is my pleasure today to introduce Bob Musil. Mr. Musil is the chairman of the board and senior policy advisor of 2020 Vision, Energy, Environment, and Security Solutions in Washington, D.C. He's also scholar in residence and adjunct professor in the School of International Studies at American University, where he teaches in the program on global environmental politics and the Nuclear Studies Institute. Until 2006, he was the longest-serving executive director and CEO of Physicians for Social Responsibility, where, over his 15-year tenure, he nearly tripled PSR's membership, staff, and budget, and built its global environmental program. Physicians for Social Responsibility won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. He is a graduate of Yale and Northwestern Universities and the John Hopkins School of Public Health, and was a visiting honorary fellow at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and of Pembroke College, Cambridge University. He was awarded a Doctor of Humane Letters from Mitchell College in May 2009. Dr. Musil is also a former Army captain who taught communications and policy at the Defense Information School, Fort Benjamin, Harrison, Indiana. Additionally, he was the executive producer and host of Consider the Alternatives, a weekly radio program syndicated to over 150 stations with 2 million listeners, and a two-time winner of the Armstrong Award for Excellence in Radio Broadcasting. Please join me in welcoming Bob Musil to our podium.
Oh, my goodness. And thank you very much for that overly kind introduction. I feel right at home with the public radio folks over there, but that video camera is, you know, I like to hide in a studio where you can do the good morning, this is Bob Edwards kind of thing. And so if I lapse into pseudo radio sound, you'll know what's going on. It's just a great pleasure for me to be here with the World Affairs Council. You do wonderful work and bring speakers far more famous than Bob Musil to your many venues, but here in Anchorage. This is my first time in Alaska, so I am more excited than you can possibly believe for a boy raised on, you know, Jack London. And I won't go through my old stereotypes, but I have gotten a wonderful sense already of folks here in Alaska. I want to thank Lisa, a fellow executive director. She is a gem with her staff, with Kari, did a lot of the work, and board members. I've already gotten to go down the Turnagain Arm, saw an eagle, saw Mount McKinley. I got a wonderful tour of the Alaska Museum by Nancy Eliason the other day, and because I have my career is even longer than that. I've taught American studies. When I got in a museum with all of those displays and the history of Alaska and Native peoples, I was just a hog in heaven. It was just wonderful. I want to say hi. Did any of those lovely students from service have to hear me the other day? You did? Oh, good. I can use the same jokes. Okay. And the same text. But that was also wonderful. I've just gotten more experiences here than you can imagine. I've been interested in Alaska for a long time. I've never been here, as I said. But I've already noticed the changes that are going on. I don't want to talk about the horrors of global climate change with you. I am an environmentalist, Physicians for Social Responsibility is a leading environmental group, part of 35 organizations called the Green Group that function in Washington as a coalition, a lobby, concerned about the environment and human health and global climate change. And together we represent perhaps 15 million Americans whose sole interest is the environment and human health. So I'm an environmentalist, but I'm not one of those gloom and doom environmentalists. And I actually get quite uncomfortable when my friends would say, you know, get out of that chair. Do you know what that's made of? Toxic materials and metal that comes from radioactive waste. And get out. Stop that. Or I go to drink from a bottle on a campus, and they'll say, where are you going to throw that? You know, that's just awful that you're using a bottle. Drink with your hands. Or, you know, stuff like that. I'm sorry. It never worked with me when someone would shake a finger and say, you are a bad person. And it has not worked for me when people tell me the planet is dying, we're all going to fry, the ice is melting. The conclusion is, there's not much we can do about it, is there? And I often say, forgive me if you have kids on college campuses, I'll say, well, if it's that bad, why are we here in class? Let's go out and party, you know, that if the world is coming to an end. So I do not like to deal in gloom. I don't need to tell you that average temperatures in Alaska have risen by 7 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 50 years. If we don't change our ways, they will rise by another 13 degrees Fahrenheit in winter temperatures by the end of this century. I think you know that the ice is melting and the polar bears are having trouble hunting. I was also at a wonderful lecture over at UAA last night with Seth Cantor, who's a local environmental writer who grew up living with Native peoples in the north. And he talked about the melting was going on, the difficulties. And it struck me, one phrase that he used really struck me. He said, imagine that you live where all of the roads were melting. And since I get stuck in traffic in Washington daily, it was an image that just struck with me. But I don't need to tell you that. The title of this talk included signs of hope, reasons for hope. And the real reasons are, as I want to sell you my book, which is called, I'm sorry, Rob, this is called Hope for a Heated Planet. I have 6 valuable copies over on the desk available from the author at $20. I'll sign them and write impassioned things in them if you so choose. But I honestly, I just can't function. I haven't found a good way to organize Americans to talk about gloom and doom, to guilt trip them, to talk about how bad things are, but rather I want to offer you a few signs of hope in the time that we have together. One of them, of course, is I mentioned your executive director, Lisa, as I said, is a gem. I don't know how she and her staff managed to pull off the feat of having Bob Musil and President Obama arrive in Anchorage at the exact same time. It's amazing. Kudos. But I think we understand that with the president passing through on the way to Asia, that things have changed in Washington. Some of you may have voted for change. But we're at a critical moment in terms of global climate change and energy policy. Obviously, in a short time in December, we will be looking to see if we can sign a new global climate change treaty in Copenhagen, Denmark. I was at Kyoto, and I've waited a long time for another treaty. We also have legislation right now in front of the Senate, an American clean energy bill that offers a cap-and-trade system for the first time would restrict the amount of carbon dioxide that could be pumped up into the atmosphere. It has already passed the House of Representatives. And, of course, many of my environmental friends who I like to tease, it's already too watered down. It's not strong enough. And the Obama administration, what a disappointment. I wanted a treaty that would ban everything. And they're making all these compromises. And I don't know if we're going to get something out of Copenhagen. And so I try to say to people, let's look at the signs of hope. When I was at Kyoto, one of my roles with the other environmental organizations was actually to push Al Gore forward. He had not won the Nobel Peace Prize yet, nor had Obama. Only me. No, my organization. I'm sorry, did I? We're on radio. I have to be careful. But we literally, because the Clinton administration was extremely cautious and they had lots of opposition and they were elected as a minority government, we literally had to push Al Gore to go to Kyoto. And we faced 100 American corporations organized into the Global Climate Coalition trying to prevent any progress, any treaty, any advancement to deal with global warming. And as it turned out, we got a treaty. But when the Senate had already voted 95-0 against Kyoto, the Global Climate Coalition of 100 coalitions and the Chamber of Commerce were already organizing and had already convinced most Americans that the treaty was junk, it was overcomplex, it was unfair that the United States might have to make cuts when the developing world did, and it all just foundered. And so I look back and I say, now what's going on now that we've returned, that we can see that we're on the verge of a new treaty, whatever its strength. We're possibly on the verge of legislation for the first time that would deal nationwide with understandings and limitations and what amount of carbon we could do. And how did that happen? The answer is those environmentalists that I make fun of had to change their ways. We were busy talking to Bill Clinton and Al Gore in the White House all that time and never came out to Anchorage, Alaska, never talked to people in Georgia, never did the kind of grassroots organizing, public education, talking to real Americans, you know, that about global climate change. And so we had to change our ways. We had to reframe our message because we understood that environmentalists, if you say the word quickly, environmentalists, what do you think of? Wacky, did I hear? Backpacking, elitist. If there are members of the Sierra Club here, forgive me. But I said we represented perhaps 13 million Americans who were organized around the environment. That does not make a majority of the American public. And so we spent many years feeling a little bit in exile that we needed to reframe what we talked about and move away from just simply discussing the environment and actually maybe talk about people and their lives and their jobs and energy, national security issues, business. We spent a lot of time figuring this out. End result, flash forward, signs of hope. At Kyoto, I mentioned 100 corporations were opposed to us. There still are. There are 2,340 new active anti-climate change lobbyists, mostly from the coal industry, some from oil and gas, some from others. They outspend all environmental groups and all renewable energy groups 10 to 1 on Capitol Hill. They have four lobbyists for every member of Congress. They spent $141 million last year, including ads during the Super Bowl for clean coal. You can ask me about that. And so there is still opposition. But what has happened in the corporate world is a sea change, that those of us who realize we weren't talking to ordinary Americans, and I include in that business people, some of my friends started with the President's Council on Sustainability back in the early 90s. Another friend of mine started the Pew Climate Center for Corporations. Another worked at Ceres, a group that pulled together corporations to work on this. So today, what we find is in terms of business coalitions who are concerned about climate change, who want to see legislation, including cap and trade bills that are in front of the Congress right now, and they have these wonderful names, USCAP, or USCAP, U.S. Climate Action Partnership. Some of these names may sound familiar to you. BP, ConocoPhillips, Dow, Duke Energy, the FPL Group, the largest renewable energy group in the country, General Motors, General Electric. Most of these people were opposed to us and had Gucci-wearing lobbyists in Kyoto. Now they want action. They want to see a world emerge not only in which the polar bears and their kids would have a future, but where there are business opportunities where, unless the playing field is made clear, unless there are ways you can understand how to build a business, and there are opportunities to make money in an entirely new economy built on renewable resources that it will take some transition to get through. There are even business coalitions a step beyond the group I just mentioned. This one I like is called BICEP. You would never see an environmentalist except Arnold Schwarzenegger, flexing their muscles. But BICEP is a business for innovative environmental policies, and it includes a whole interesting group of folks. BICEP has got, let's see here, I'm getting my corporations mixed up, forgive me. It's got The Gap, it's got Timberland Clothing, it's got Sun Microsystems, it's got folks who are a little more engaged in consumer services, electronics, and they take a slightly bolder approach than the U.S. Climate Action Partnership. They actually, under the cap-and-trade system, want to auction off, that was their position, the credits. You'd have to buy the credits that would allow you to pollute if you were still polluting, and they were in favor of that. Then they put together a coalition that is lobbying right now. I mentioned there are still lobbyists against doing anything about climate change, from my point of view. But there's a new lobby, 150 corporations that have banded together and are going to Capitol Hill regularly. And if you are there, you will see not only environmentalists and not only the traditional lobbyists who want to sort of stop things, let's say the coal people, if you will, but also squadrons of very impressive-looking lobbyists from corporations. For me, that is an incredible sign of hope, that this nation's business has understood how important it is for all of us to do something about climate change and what opportunities there are in energy, in buildings, in renewables, in all sorts of things that are going forward. I ended up working with a plug-in electric vehicle campaign in Washington with Toyota, General Motors, ABC, battery manufacturers, people advocating for the smart grid, in other words, a number of environmental groups, along with folks. I can tell you that I actually opposed General Motors in the past and the United Auto Workers, mostly over clean air issues. And my friend Senator Levin, the liberal Democrat from Michigan, who never saw any clean air problem because he was defending the way we did things in Michigan. That has all changed. People have understood. Obviously, General Motors, after they killed the electric car, made some terrible decisions. Now they're moving toward the Volt and electric vehicles. And this was stimulated by coalitions of business and environmentalists understanding the opportunities that are there. In fact, for me, another sign of hope is here's an environmental action right now that's going on by groups that I work with. They have a coalition called SaveTheEnvironment.org. This looks like a group that has, you're texting each other and you've got your BlackBerries all. No. Anyhow, you can go to the web. You can click onto a petition campaign against Toyota. Now listen to this. The reason, Toyota, which is, as you know, the Prius is a green corporation. I could tell you at great length on how they have already done energy efficiency in their Southern California plants in Torrance, where they make pickup trucks through energy efficiency and their engines and fans and drying processes and how they do the paint. But they are still members of the Chamber of Commerce, which is one of the leading groups opposing legislation on Capitol Hill about global climate change. Some of you may belong to the Chamber of Commerce, and therefore you might know that there are huge splits going on, that the number of corporations that have dropped out of the Chamber because it is fighting global climate change legislation, which includes General Electric and other big corporations, have said, I'm not going to be part of your chamber if you're going to keep fighting about the future of the planet. And so Toyota, which is a wonderful corporation, is going to get a petition. All it says is, golly, you know, you're so good, we'd like to see you go with all these other big corporations and stop even participating with a group that would oppose this. So we've moved from a world where environmentalists were sort of reflexively anti-business, if I may be clear, and where business was sort of reflexively anti-environmentalists, those backpacking Sierra Club weirdos. And we have formed tremendous partnerships that are moving the economy forward, where our actions are down to sort of saying to Toyota, you know, you're really good. Come on along and join the parade. For me, that is a light years change and gives tremendous hope for the future. Similarly, I've been having a wonderful time talking here because I was an Army captain. As we were talking with Rod, whose career went quite a bit further than mine, I stopped at Army Captain, where I trained people in public relations and radio, the Defense Information School. I mean, at the Defense Information School. No comment. Have you ever dropped a nuclear weapon out of a plane? Moving right along. Anyhow, we did a fine job. We trained it. But I was thinking how much has changed also in the area of the Department of Defense. You should understand that most of the nation's military sees climate change as a threat to our national security, that I've worked very, very closely with the Center for Naval Analyses, who put out a tremendous report in 2007 done by 13 three- and four-star admirals and generals on the threat to our national security. If we have sea level rise, golly, there may be a few island-based air bases and naval stations go underwater. Could be a problem. If we get our energy from natural gas or oil that happens to come from countries that are not exactly democratic and friendly all the time, or we have to sort of beg from the Russians, we need some new kinds of energy. We also use huge amounts in the armed forces. And a whole piece of the logistics train is getting fuel to where the troops and ships and Humvees are. So you put this all together, our over-dependence on fossil fuels both in the way we deploy our troops, where we get engaged in areas from Uzbekistan, concerns about Nigeria and Venezuela. All of these are national security threats related to our fossil fuel dependence and changes that will affect our troops. And so on Veterans Day, I was happy to discuss this with a number of you who are veterans. And I now speak regularly with 3- and 4-star admirals and generals. I was just at Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, with Admiral Lee Gunn, who's the head of all of naval personnel, one of a number of these people. And that's what I do regularly. They all stand straighter than I do, but we make quite a team. And it's a long way from the stereotypes of the backpackers. And if you are backpacking, forgive me. But the national security emphasis is one that it took environmentalists a long time to understand, that we needed to worry about the future of this country and how it would be defended, or whether we were overextended and sending troops to places that maybe they shouldn't have been in the first place. And those are the kinds of concerns that are now central to what's happening in Washington, around the Department of Defense, and a sign of hope for me. I was down in Georgia, for example, where I met with the head of sustainability at Fort Benning. Have you ever been to Fort Benning? Sir. Well, it's exciting. Suffice to say, they are going green. I know their sustainability officer, Peter Lucan, who is in charge of $3 billion worth of green construction at Fort Benning that is going on. We're talking green buildings. They all have to meet at least LEED's silver certification for green buildings. They're bringing in electric vehicles. They're reducing their carbon footprint. And this is throughout the Department of Defense and throughout many, many, many military facilities. Orders for 4,000 electric cars for openers throughout our services. It is, again, a sea change from just a few years ago. And for me, it's a tremendous sign of hope. I was talking to Clyde Hutchins. Clyde, are you around here? You may or may not know that he's originally from LaGrange, Georgia. I picked up on that right away because I get invited to speak in Georgia. And so I was, and that's how I met originally Peter Lucan from Fort Benning. And I also met his brother, Jeff Lucan, who's the mayor of LaGrange. I also was speaking at LaGrange College. And so if you're not familiar with LaGrange, it's down in southwest Georgia near Alabama. I'm a New Yorker. It's not what I would think of as Sierra Club territory. Did I say that okay? I don't know. Well, turns out that Mayor Lucan has an entire sustainability project for the city that he has helped to bring a biomass energy facility. That's where you take wood. It's all chopped up, and in high pressures, it is burned in ways that give off extremely tiny amounts of pollutants. And my environmental friends might say, "What? There was one little piece of wood got out of there." But the truth is, it's considered a green technology, and more importantly for Southwest Georgia, that depends on forestry and furniture. If you are in the lumber and furniture business, the waste wood, the chips get literally left in the pine forest, and then they rot, and then they give off methane, which is an incredibly powerful greenhouse gas that is going to ruin climate change. And so what you have going on in many places in southwest Georgia is enlightened citizen leadership at the local and city level to bring new kinds of technologies. And I mention Jeff Lucan, the mayor, because another sign of hope, in addition to business, national security, and generals, is the local leadership in this country. Local politicians. That is a word you wouldn't expect, you know, like. So there is a group you may or may not know called the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Group. They have a climate protection agreement There are 1,050 U.S. mayors representing nearly 100 million Americans who have pledged themselves to reduce the carbon footprint and the giving off of CO2 gases in their towns and cities to below 1990 levels, sort of back to what we agreed to at the Kyoto Accords and never signed, never lived up to. That includes Mark Begich, before he became senator. I think you know, here in Anchorage, we're talking about LED lights to replace the older incandescent style that just burn up energy and waste energy. But all over the country, this is happening with electric police cars and fire departments and green city halls. And it was stimulated, again, by a partnership between environmentalists. Now I'm going to say a nice thing about the Sierra Club. They have something called the Cool Cities Campaign that actually helped to stimulate and recruit these folks so that Mayor Greg Nickels of Seattle, who was the first founding member of this Mayor's Protection Agreement, was working with environmentalists. Others became involved. And so we have seen tremendous, tremendous changes at the local level. Most people don't know that this is going on. Here in Anchorage, you would, because you have had one of those 1,050 mayors committed to improving life and energy use in Anchorage, and it's going on all over the country. And that was another lesson that we environmentalists had to learn. You know, I said I went to Kyoto, I talked to Bill Clinton, but I forgot to talk to the mayor. And they have tremendous influence on what happens in this country. And now that has all changed. I'll tick off a few more positive changes. I mean, we've got business, national security, local government. Another one that is of interest to me, I neglected to say that these mayors have now banded together, and the first result is that they've gotten an energy block grant from Obama's stimulus package that is providing $2.8 billion in clean energy support for various cities and towns around the country. So it is already bearing fruit. But I wanted to say a word about religion. My bio didn't say, because it's so ridiculously long, I can't stay with one thing too long. But I also teach occasionally at the Wesley United Methodist Theological Seminary in Washington on global climate change and religious responses to it. And I'm also the head of the Sustainability Creation Care Group at my local congregational church in Bethesda, Maryland. I'm also the fundraiser, Rod. I do the stewardship. But I'm not going to ask you either to come on up front. I do have a long line of preachers from New England, but I am not one. But don't tempt me. But the truth be told, again, environmentalists were down on religion. And there's a reason they're sometimes were considered pagans. You know, hugging trees, loving rocks. I mean, weird stuff, right? And a friend of mine, Carl Pope, the head of the Sierra Club, actually apologized at a symposium held by Bartholomew I, the head of the Eastern Orthodox Church, on religion and the environment. My friend Paul Gorman, who started the National Religious Partnership of the Environment, said, why didn't the headline say, Pope repents? This is Carl Pope saying, you know, we didn't get it about religion. You know, we thought there was an article once that said that it was the Judeo-Christian tradition that had put, you know, God and man over there and the earth and the environment, you know, you can do it what you want, increase and multiply and do whatever, you know, we're in charge here. Well, it took a long time, again, for environmentalists to understand that this was a misreading of the history of both Jewish thought and Christian thought, that there was huge strands of care and concern for the earth, for God's creatures. And so Carl Pope, head of the Sierra Club, not only repented, he hired people to work with the faith-based members of the Sierra Club. Turns out nearly 60% of them were going to church. I thought they were pagans. That development, which led to the National Religious Partnership for the Environment, that includes Jewish communities, Christian communities, some Muslims, other faiths, gave rise to a broad faith-based movement in this country that I have to tell you, I did give two Earth Day sermons. I won't repeat them here at the World Affairs Council. But the truth be told, my pagan tree-hugging friend who runs the Earth Day Network helped to organize 12,000 Earth Day sermons in synagogues and in churches around this country in 2 different years. So I gave 2 different Earth Day sermons. So there were 12,000 of them. If you can imagine every Starbucks in the land, then double the number of Starbucks, and then have a Jewish or Christian service focused on God's creation and climate change, you begin to have an idea what is going on in this country. You don't see this on television. You would find it on public radio, but it's hard to know these things are going on. There are 4,000 congregations, Jewish and Christians, involved in the Interfaith Power and Light, a national organization run by a woman who is a Episcopalian canon. Sally Bingham is her name. They have 4,000 congregations, and they actually... the reason Al Gore's movie did so well is they organized 4,000 different viewings of his movie. Other folks did the same thing. And so I don't know if any of you have been involved in that, but if you want hope, whatever your faith or none, the fact is that this is a religious country, and huge numbers of people are deeply concerned at the local level in their synagogues and temples. In our church, we're dealing with the heating and electricity. We have services. We have educational programs. We're working and fighting coal mountaintop removal in West Virginia. This is going on all over the land. And surely that is a sign of hope. Let's cut to the bottom line here. I do teach at American University. I mentioned the seminary. In colleges and universities, I was at UAA the other night, and that's where I heard Seth Cantor. And it turns out that UAA is part of something called ASHI, the Association of Sustainability in Higher Education. 640 American universities and colleges are dedicated to becoming carbon neutral, have sustainability programs, are building green buildings. There are another similar number of college presidents who have signed the college president's commitment on climate change, where they will move their institutions toward carbon neutrality, environmental sustainability, and there's an entire national network of these folks. But it turns out that Fran Ulmer of UAA is a signer and a leader on these issues, as was Elaine Myman before her. So right here in Anchorage, again, part of a nationwide change, you're seeing tremendous progress on campuses. And then finally, people say to me, Bob, you go to campuses all the time. What's the matter with young people these days? I don't know if any of you... we're 60s activists. I'm a reformed 60s activist, hence the tie. A red tie. I wanted you to know I was from Washington. But people say they're just not active the way they used to be. They don't care the way they used to be. And I said, what are you smoking? No, I didn't say that. There are 1 million organized college students just on global climate change through the Energy Action Coalition. It's more than 45 different student organizations, Student Sierra Club, the Student Pergs. I could go on, Youth Audubon, Campus Ecology, run by the National Wildlife Federation. And they can be organized with a click of a mouse. And they are deeply engaged and far, far more sophisticated than those of us who used bullhorns back in the 60s. Stay in your building and you won't be harmed. I don't know. I don't know what we thought we were doing. It wasn't institutional change. It wasn't attracting adherents to the cause. These folks are doing really serious work. And so they organize something called Power Shift. And help me here. How many of you have not heard of Power Shift? Good, good, good. Get on there. Okay. Because if you had, I couldn't continue. Simply put, they are able to organize at a click of a mouse The first time they did this, they brought 5,000 college students to Washington to work on global climate change. This past year, 12,000 college students spent a week at a conference on global climate change. 5,000 of them stayed on to lobby every single member of Congress in the United States Congress. I happened, because I was a crazed activist in my youth, in the 1980s, you may remember the nuclear freeze. I co-hosted the lobby day with Representative Ed Markey, who now works on global climate change, and there were 5,000 citizen lobbyists come to Washington. It was beyond belief. It was historic. No citizen public interest group had ever seen a turnout like that, of adults of all sorts. So when I tell you that 5,000 American college students came to Washington just to lobby on global climate change, and I know you don't know about it because it does not get covered. What gets covered, I guess if they went and took over a building or burned a flag or did something stupid, it might show up on the evening media. But if you're doing serious work and actually making a difference, it gets less attention, but it is happening nonetheless. And so when I was at Service High School, I said to that group, as I will to the Model UN, when you get to college, not only are we going to learn through your courses, but as American citizens, in the best, most open democracy in the world, you have to get involved. It's also easy to get involved. If you care about climate change or the UN or treaties, you are not alone. You're not weird anymore. You are part of huge numbers of people like yourselves, a million of you. And out of that group will come the future leaders of the World Affairs Council, the mayors, the senators, the business leaders, the generals, the next generation of people who will lead this country into a glorious future in which we will do something about climate change. We will have a new economy. We will have new businesses. We will have renewable energy. And it is all because of these wonderful, wonderful people that I urge all of you to continue your efforts with the World Affairs Council, with the many civic organizations and religious organizations and military organizations that I know you're all engaged with. That's why, for me, it has been a privilege just to be with the Shakers and Movers here in Anchorage. I will tell wonderful stories about this place, from its beauty to the dangers from climate change, to what is being done in this city and throughout this state to do something to build a better future for us and our children. And so I thank you for your caring and your concern.
We have time for a couple of questions. Would you please stand? And the mic back there, there's a hand.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's great that there are so many signs of hope. However, I read in, I think it's the last Economist, that recent polls have shown that there has been a significant fall in the percentage of people who see climate change as a serious or one of their most serious topics. And I wonder if you care to comment on that?
Yeah, I do. It's a great question. I work with pollsters. Obviously, a lot depends on how you ask questions. A lot depends on what is in the news. In this wonderful book that I saw outside, Hope for a Heated Planet, I talk a little bit about that, and I say, you know, climate change will surely disappear under the waves again, as it always does. The economy, as I was finishing, was starting to go down, and right now we're obsessed with healthcare, that sort of thing. Since the peak of interest, and I joked about Al Gore, but with his Nobel Peace Prize, with the IPCC winning an award for their science on climate change, with a report on the Arctic in 2004, which is where I got some of my information on how things are melting and how bad they are, that was in the news. And so, yes, you would find people saying, climate change is on my mind. The other thing is that climate change, because of what I was describing of environmentalists doing, we tend to talk about it as clean energy, renewable energy, helping national security. I mean, climate change is such a vast question that if you ask people what are they interested in, if they said their children's health, I then could give you another lecture on how climate change exacerbates asthma, leads to cardiovascular disease, that the outpourings of coal-fired utilities put stuff down in your alveoli, and men in particular look out for those heart attacks. But that doesn't show up. Or if they talk about they're interested in jobs and the economy, well, what I've just been trying to talk about, all of these business leaders building a new economy, the president putting $150 billion into renewables into the 2010 budget, that's climate change. But if you just say, well, is the first thing you worry about when you wake up climate change? No. So that's. But if you say, how about would you pay more for clean energy that would help the country? Americans say yes. Seriously. Go.
Right here.
I hear the word anthropogenic warming. This involves people, of course. What if our objectives and our work towards reducing climate change projects out 20 years, and at that time our population has doubled? What's the arithmetic? Is it zero?
I didn't plant this question. Thank you. Thank you, sir. I must admit, I'm on the board of Population Connection, something that used to be called Zero Population Growth. And since you're not responsible for any of the opinions of speakers here, I will not talk about family planning or anything else. But the fact is, you may be familiar with a little formula that was put together by Paul Ehrlich to talk about the impact of humans on the environment is population times affluence times technology. And we tend to talk in the climate debate, the energy debate, about the technology part. We need more efficient factories, better cars. We talk about how people could perhaps change their lifestyles. But unless we get some handle on population, it will affect climate change. What's tricky about it is, of course, that in the developing world, the poorer countries in the southern portion of the hemisphere, they use on average about one-tenth of the energy of the average American. And so if we each had three kids, we would be adding more carbon footprint. U.S. population is still growing, not anything like some other countries. So some concern for population is important, and then there are fairly obvious reasons that a lot of people have stopped talking about it. It's that one of those things that'll ruin your Thanksgiving dinner if you start talking about choice and abortion and reproductive health, and it's fairly complicated, but people have shied away from it. And the other part, I think, is that demographers told us that we were reaching a demographic transition where the world's population would just level off at 9 billion. We're at 6.5 or so. Well, if the following things happen, and that's a heck of a lot of people and a lot more carbon footprint. So we do have to pay attention to the population. Thank you. Oh, wow.
Since you got here, you've probably heard that there are quite a few additional improbable environmentalists here as a result of our interest in a natural gas pipeline. I have a two-part question, regrettably. One is, do you agree that natural gas is the interim fuel? And secondly, of course, if you look at today's market, for example, a gas pipeline is unfeasible. And the ability to build that line depends on making coal and fractured shale pay their environmental externalities. This is a very difficult time economically. The economy's stupid. How can our administration now tell people in the coal fields that they have to stop working or become non-competitive?
Okay, well, let me just try to put them together. It's in the category of transition fuels, essentially, other than new renewables. With natural gas, I skipped over a story that I think is very interesting, where President Obama was in Florida, in Arcadia, Florida, just a couple of weeks ago, announcing $3.4 billion for the smart grid, which is why General Electric, among other reasons, is interested in climate legislation, et cetera. But he did it at a solar facility there that is also going to be building a new next generation solar thermal and natural gas facility, in which the solar thermal provides most of the power, but when there isn't enough sun, it shifts over to natural gas. I worked on projects, for example, on the Mexico border in El Paso, where the people who live in the colonias were burning tires, treated wood, anything to make bricks in little homemade kilns. And we entered into a project with El Paso Natural Gas and Sandia Laboratories to make more efficient kilns and to have natural gas, which is a much cleaner fuel. We weren't getting as many sick neighbors and workers in these poor parts of... And so natural gas, I think, is a transition fuel. It has some dangers. I worry a lot. We were talking about national security, about terrorism, and when we talk about nuclear power, natural gas, things like that, we always have to factor in how safe are the liquid natural gas facilities, the pipelines, et cetera. But they can be guarded. They're, you know, the odds of them being blown up or disrupted are pretty low. So I think natural gas is a cleaner fuel. Very little pollution. It does give off some carbon dioxide, but it's way better than a coal-fired utility. Now, if you ask about the coal, I mentioned I make fun of my environmental friends. They're a little concerned about Obama because he's got lots of coal, clean coal money. And you saw the clean coal ads from the coalition that I mentioned at the Super Bowl, and they show Obama talking about clean coal. And Illinois, of course, is a coal state, like many, 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 many places. And so there's a fair amount of money in clean coal technologies in the stimulus package, in the new budget, and included in the clean energy bill that's moving out of the House and Senate. So... and that's partly because of economic realities. What I say in the book, which is just a fascinating book, in case you can... No. Basically, ultimately, we should move away from coal. It's very hard to burn coal without some sort of danger. I've been involved in many campaigns to try to help young women understand that they have to look out for mercury in fish. Mercury comes out of burning coal, it goes into the water, it gets turned into methylmercury, it ends up in the fish, you eat it, it can affect developing embryos and fetuses. It's dangerous, and I worked on a lot of mercury rules, trying to control it out of coal-fired utilities. Same with SOx and NOx and air pollution, and it's why you have to get your car tested for SOx and NOx, but it also comes out of coal-fired. And then the questions of the miners. Jobs are being lost in the coal industry, not because of environmentalists, but because the coal industry is moving to mountaintop removal, to huge operations out in the West where they scoop it with giant combines. The old image, for those of us who are a little older, a couple of folks here in the room, the guys, you know, with the smudgy faces and the light and the pickaxe are getting fewer anyhow. But there is concern for that and transition programs, and you can't move from one economy to a next without some help, some transition. But this is where some of my environmental friends are very concerned that Obama's selling out and the bills are too weak. But you simply have to imagine we have to turn the entire American economy around. There's lots of benefit there. And in the meantime, there's going to be some natural gas. There's going to be some nukes. There's going to be some coal. But over the long haul, I personally think that we need to ultimately move totally away from those fuels for environmental and health and other security reasons. It was a great question, though. I've got to answer shorter.
Yes, Chris Thompson.
Hi.
Just a question in taking the longer run and just looking at where we're going in terms of connectedness. We feel here in Alaska that we've got a lot of good connectedness with our environment, getting out fishing, doing those type of things. And I'm interested in your comments or thoughts as we look at, like, Last Child in the Woods, the lack of connectedness, just being an advocate for, you know, the kind of the a portion of the healthcare component that is getting us out there and connected, but sort of leave no child inside and become connected, you know, as we do. Yeah. So when I say longer run, it's not just Nordic skiing, but it's actually being involved and caring, whether it's any group, whether it's hunting or fishing or the Sierra Club or, you know, Ducks Unlimited. They're all reporting fewer contact hours with nature. And any thoughts, you know?
It's a great question. I try to think about it quickly because with these heads of organizations, I mentioned 35 of them, we met regularly. We went in retreats. We went on spiritual retreats. We did communication studies. And we all worried that we had had some experience, some special place, some experience with nature. In my case, I grew up on Long Island, for God's sake. How did I get to experience nature? Well, I'm old enough when there was no Levittown, no Long Island Expressway, when I saw monarchs migrating, where there were small local farms where you got truck farming. You know, you talk about locavores now, we should get back to local food. That's what we did on Long Island before they paved it. And so I was very aware, and it is harder. I think it's not impossible. I could tell you many, many stories, particularly in universities, where they tried to go sustainable and they run into opposition. I'm thinking of Emory University in Atlanta. It's an urban university. No one had any idea of what sort of ecosystem they were sitting on top of in Atlanta. And the woods that were part of the campus had long since become dangerous, filled with trash, and no one would go there. And so the early environmental activists at Emory literally cleaned up the woods. They began to have tours. They took people out there, even just to explain that even in Atlanta, sprawl capital of the country, there was an ecosystem under there. And that began to develop consciousness that led ultimately to glittering green medical facilities, sustainability throughout the campus. It's just an incredible turnaround. So there are a lot of programs to do this. I think it is important that people have contact with nature. We've even had medical studies for green hospitals, and these are serious studies that you're over there, your hospital room, if you look behind you, there are no windows, right? And out there, you're looking at the mountains. Guess who recovers more quickly, has better recovery rates? The green side. Just demonstrated in studies. And so now, when we build new kinds of hospitals and medical care, it's not just the energy and the air conditioning and LEEDs buildings, but a whole understanding of connecting people up to their families who can come stay to nature. And we got a lot of this also from Norwegians. So a lot of attention to it. It's very, very important, and I'm glad you asked it because I'm going to go back out into the glorious nature here in Alaska, which will keep me working on this subject for at least another generation as I go back to Washington, where we also have wonderful nature. It's not just the world of beltway bandits and politicians. Come back there, you'll see some wonderful nature right where I live along the C&O Canal. I described the glories in the book about Maryland, where I actually have seen 7 miles from my house in Bethesda, foxes eating goslings, etc. So, again, thanks for a great question. Thank you all for your care and concern of coming out to hear the famous Bob Musil.
Thank you, Bob. We also have a book, and we'd like to give it to you as a token of our appreciation for addressing us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. This is awesome.
Our next program will be on Friday, the 4th of December, and medical doctor Tim Thomas will be our guest speaker, speaking on his work with AIDS in Kenya. That's on the 4th of December, Friday. Hope to see you all then. We're taking a Thanksgiving break. Thank you.